I want to welcome everyone to our February 2023 Learn While You Lunch. My name is Diane Corbin. I'm the owner and executive director of Merrimack Valley Trauma Services. And I want to remind everyone that today's topic is what is trauma therapy and how it differs from mental health counseling. And I want to introduce two members of my team, two wonderful staff that I'm so privileged to have on my team. We have Callie Sebastian.
Hi, everybody.
And we have Tristan Keane.
Hello, everybody. It's so great to see some faces again.
And they both work at our South Carolina office. During this presentation, you are going to need one 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. So just like a regular piece of paper and a writing utensil for an exercise that we're going to do. So if you could just get that ready. Let's talk a little bit about Merrimack Valley Trauma Services. For those of you that don't know us, you're probably wondering where Merrimack Valley is. It's actually the 25 cities and towns along the Merrimack River in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And so that's where I am from. And so we still have our office, our corporate office is based in Massachusetts, and we opened this office here in South Carolina in 2019. So I opened Merrimack Valley Trauma Services in 2010 because there was such a need for trauma-focused services for children and families. And at the time I was working in the early intervention system in Massachusetts and saw that lots of kids were coming into our system, so birth to three, so basically babies, that had these horrendous trauma histories. There was no place to send them. So we decided to provide trauma-focused services within the early intervention system. And that became the seeds of what Merrimack Valley Trauma Services has become. So basically, our model is attachment-focused. We always focus on the relationship between the parent and the caregiver and the child. It's parent-led, and I'll talk to you about what that means in a moment. An empowerment and strengths-based model. We believe that people can heal themselves with the right tools and the right resources. And that's what our role is to help them heal themselves. We are very committed to community partnerships, as evidenced by today's presentation, our monthly Learn While You Lunch. We also have partnerships with Berkeley Public School District and the Formation Project, which is a really great project that helps victims of human trafficking and sex trafficking based in Charleston. We provide trauma-focused mental health counseling to children as young as two, all the way to adults. We have various support services for caregivers. We call this parenting support services, which I'll talk about a little bit. And then we also offer evaluation, trauma evaluations, consultation and training services to lots of different community partners, school districts, et cetera. I think one of the things that makes us different is number one is our staff. So I'm pretty picky about who I hire. So that's a shout out to Callie and Tristan. All of our staff are licensed. They receive ongoing training and supervision. And like I said, they all have a passion for a focus on disadvantaged populations, specifically at-risk children. But children grow up to be adults, so we have to work with adults as well. I think the second thing that makes us different is our focus on the family. So I always say that when you enter into treatment, you sort of get a 3-for-1. And what that means is we focus on the child, you know, with individual therapy. We also focus on parents. We meet with parents separately, but then we also focus on the relationship between the child and the parent or the caregiver. It's a very unique model, and we've had a lot of success over the years working with this model and seeing families move through trauma and heal from trauma. So as I said before, we have many different parenting support services, including coaching. We have a program for children. It's actually for parents whose children were sexually abused. We have an intentional parenting program, and that's really geared towards parents with their own trauma histories. Who doesn't have a trauma history? Parents who are struggling to parent their child because of their own trauma history. That's what this program is geared toward. We're also very clear. I want to make it known, because I know there are some GALs in the audience today. We are very clear about our role as community therapists. So we do not give our opinion about custody or parental capacity or visitation or any legal questions. That would be the role of a forensic interviewer. And that's something that we do separately. But as a community therapist, we won't give our opinion because we have found that it definitely disrupts the therapeutic relationship. That might be something that I focus on in a different talk to discuss that, but I just want to mention that. And I think the other reason that makes us, you know, that kind of sets us apart from other agencies is that we have low caseloads. So we really focus on fewer clients, which means we're going to be able to provide a more intense level of service and we can make progress more quickly. So we're really focused on the quality versus the quantity of our services. And our goal is really to get ourselves out of a job. So we want to help kids spend less time in therapy and really empower parents and their caregivers to take over as the therapist instead of having them come to see us. Right now, we're trying to increase our access to our services and maximize our capacity to see as many kids and families as possible. As you can see, we only have 3 people in our office in South Carolina. So we're very serious about the work that we do. And we really want to work with kids and families that are ready to do the work of healing. So I hope that gives you sort of an overview of MBTS. Again, if you have questions, you can put them in the chat box or you can feel free to contact me privately. Last time we discussed what is mental health counseling and the stigma associated and how this matters to our work. So not just as therapists, but as providers in the community. We also discussed the different elements of the therapeutic relationship and also what is effective counseling. So today I'd like to talk about more specifically what is trauma therapy and what makes it different from other forms of mental health counseling. But before I do that, I'd like to invite you to participate in this exercise. So if you could take out your piece of paper, don't worry, we're not going to do origami, but I'm just going to have you fold it in half and then fold it in half again. Okay, so it looks like this. So you've got 4 pieces of paper. And then what I'd like you to do is tear along the lines so that you have 4 small pieces of paper. And when you're done with that, each piece of paper, you're going to label a number. So the first piece of paper will be labeled number 1, the second number 2, the third number 3, and the fourth number 4. So on the first piece of paper, so number 1, I would like you to write something that makes you feel safe. It can be a person, it can be a place, it can be, you know, somewhere you go. A situation, something that makes you feel safe. On the second piece of paper, I would like you to write the name of a person that you love the most in this world. On the third piece of paper, I would like you to write a prized possession. So that's something that you cannot bear to live without. If your house was on fire, you would grab this item because you cannot bear to live without it. Okay, and then on the fourth piece of paper, I would like you to write down a few words that describe a strong value or belief that you have. So a spiritual or religious belief or a value, like, for instance, people are essentially good. So I want you to look at your 4 pieces of paper. And I want you to close your eyes and imagine these words, these phrases, these things are part of who you are. They are part of your story, who you love, your identity, and what makes you you. Take a nice deep breath. And now I'd like you to open your eyes and I'd like you to take paper number one, crumple it up and throw it over your shoulder. Now I'd like you to take paper number two, crumple it up and throw it away. Number three, your prized possession, same thing. Crumple it up, throw it away. And finally, your strong value or belief, crumple it up and throw it away. I would like you to think for a moment, let's just reflect on this, how it feels to lose what helps you feel safe, the person you love the most, your possessions, your spiritual beliefs and values, because this is what trauma feels like. So if you could, I would invite you to share just a few words or comments describing what this was like for you. So what's coming up for you? So just in the chat box, just a word or two about what describing what this was like. If you were to take all of these things and then all of a sudden lose them. Okay, so we've got someone saying anxiety, it's anxiety producing. Someone else said abandonment, being alone and unprotected. A physical sensation of a drop in the stomach. Devastating. And one person said, I didn't even like tossing my paper away. I can't imagine this in real life. Right? Yep. Heartbreak, sadness, rage, pain, fear. Yep. Someone else said fear. This is what trauma feels like. And this is what our clients, and some of us, I mean, most of us have had some type of trauma in their lives. This is a pretty intense feel. All the feelings that you're describing is what our clients feel every day. And so here's some trauma. What do you think about when you think of trauma? You have some different images here. I show this to clients and kids, and it's interesting what they come up with when they see these images of what they think. So what are we talking about when we talk about trauma? Before we talk about trauma therapy, we really want to talk about what trauma is, right? Trauma is, I like to tell people, is a normal response to an abnormal occurrence. It's your body and your brain trying to process and trying to understand and make sense of something that should not have happened. It entails your life being threatened, a loved one's life being threatened, or witnessing something threatening. So I want to emphasize this point because a lot of people think that if the trauma didn't happen to you specifically, then it's not as damaging. But I'm here to tell you that witnessing something, witnessing violence, witnessing domestic violence, witnessing a parent using drugs, witnessing someone being hurt can be just as damaging, if not more damaging, than it happening directly to you. Right? And that has to do with how trauma is processed in the brain. So the memory of the trauma becomes imprinted. At some point, we will kind of talk about, if you'd like me to do that, I will talk to you more about trauma in the brain if that's something that's of interest to you. Your feeling of safety is compromised, right? So I feel like the trauma is still happening, even though it happened in the past, it's still happening for me. You're reliving the event over and over and over again. You're feeling like you can't trust your body because it's almost like your body is betraying you. And some people say, I feel like I'm going crazy. They have no control. It's about losing your feeling of connection. So since most trauma that children experience is at the hands of a caregiver, there's a deep sense of betrayal around the attachment relationship. There's a distorted sense of what is love. There's a feeling that the relationship is damaged. People talk about being confused and really having their sense of trust in the world being shattered. Because if you can't trust your caregiver, the person that's supposed to take care of you, who can you trust? And then number three, we talked about the prized possession. So, you know, when there's a fire, when there's a storm, when there's an accident, during war, homelessness, all of these things, or a child being removed from their home and placed in foster care, they often lose what they most value. And not just, you know, money, not just possessions, but photos of family members, special toys, places that help them feel safe, like their room. You know, I've worked with kids in foster care and they care about nothing else, but they're like, I just want that one stuffed animal that I grew up with, and it got thrown away. And then number four, the strong value or belief. So this is probably the most damaging aspect of trauma, because when your sense of safety is compromised, your belief in others has been damaged, then the world doesn't feel like a safe place anymore. And people don't feel like they're essentially good. Trauma impacts your sense of self-efficacy. Trauma impacts your sense of control, and also, unfortunately, your spiritual beliefs sometimes. I had a client say to me recently, how could God allow this? So it really makes you question even your sense of your spiritual beliefs. So what is trauma therapy? Trauma therapy takes into consideration all of these elements. We deal with safety. We focus on connection. We make sure basic needs are being met. And we also touch on spiritual beliefs and values. I like to do a lot of metaphors because I think people remember them. So I'm going to teach you a metaphor about trauma therapy and what we do at MBTS. This plastic cup represents a child's life, a child's upbringing. Okay, as you can see, you know, if we're fortunate enough, you get what you need. And this cup forms and it feels like a safe container so that when we pour water into this cup, it'll hold it, right? It can contain it. If you use the water as a way to describe maybe stress or something bad happening, right? So you're pouring water into this cup, the cup can hold it because there's a strong foundation. Now, other children, unfortunately, do not have the resources because of poverty, because of the color of their skin, because of their family they were born into, whatever the reason, they don't have that kind of cup. They have a cup that looks like this. Can everybody see that? So there's holes in the cup. So when you try to pour water into this cup, what happens? It doesn't hold the water. It can't handle the stress. So what do we do as helpers? We have our Band-Aids and we give people mental health counseling. And we say, let's give them medication, right? So we stick some medication on there and case management and lots of different very well-meaning supports. And we try to cover up that hole as best we can. What happens after time? When more and more stress enters into this cup, it doesn't stick. What I like to say we do here at Merrimack Valley Trauma Services, trauma therapy is about going into the cup. It's not about putting a Band-Aid on the outside of it. It's not just about addressing the symptoms. It's about going inside the trauma and healing it from the inside out so that what happens is that a foundation is around that. So see, the holes are still there, but now there's something around it to protect it so that when you pour water into this cup, it's going to hold it. When a child has experienced trauma and they've learned how to feel safe in their body and they've learned how to, they've learned coping strategies to deal with strong affect, just like pouring water in the cup, they're going to be able to handle that. They're going to be able to cope with it and self-regulate. So I like to say that Merrimack Valley Trauma Services is like Gorilla Glue. You familiar with Gorilla Glue? You put the Gorilla Glue in there and it really patches up that hole and can contain the water. and creates that barrier. So I hope that was a helpful metaphor for what trauma therapy is. To go over some principles, last time we talked about the relationship and how important that is. This is key to any relationship, right? A therapeutic relationship. But for trauma therapy, it's crucial. And that's why when I mentioned earlier that we don't work with court-involved families, the reason for that is because attorneys and court staff often have a very different lens and have a very different view. And, you know, attorneys want to win their case. And so they will get our records, and the other side tries to, use the documentation to win their case. And in the process, what happens is the therapeutic relationship is often destroyed. We're very protective of our relationships with our clients, and we have to be, because that is the foundation of the therapy and of healing. So we've got the relationship, trauma-focused therapy, the principles. So when I say it's always trauma-sensitive and sometimes trauma-focused, what I mean by that is we meet clients where they're at. So we're very trauma, we assume everyone coming into our building has experienced some type of trauma. So all of our protocols, our principles, our staff, our training, everything has to be through a trauma lens, right? But we don't necessarily, this is where the sometimes trauma focus, this is where this comes in. We don't always work on the trauma, because sometimes people are not ready to do that yet. So if you hear, this is a tip, if you hear of a provider who, as soon as the client comes in, and that's a child, adult, doesn't matter the age, the first thing they do is tell me the story of the trauma, that's a red flag. Because not only is that contraindicated and clinically inappropriate, but it can actually create an ab reaction. And what that means is it can re-trigger trauma for a client that is already suffering. And can actually be very damaging to them. It can re-traumatize them. Sometimes when people say, well, kids need to go into therapy so they can process their trauma. And what I have to do is a lot of education. We do a lot of education for caregivers and providers to say that that's not necessarily true. First of all, kids are very resilient. And just because they've experienced trauma doesn't mean they have to process it. And we'll talk about what that means. That's not talking about it. That's something different. Secondly, kids may not be ready. And as you know, through the exercise that we did earlier, when I said everybody just throw, you know, your prized possessions, what makes you feel safe, what makes you feel connected. When you've experienced trauma, you have this deep sense of a lack of control, like nothing is in your control. So to have a child come into therapy when they don't want to and try to force them to talk about their trauma is the opposite of what we want to do. We want to give them as much control as possible. So when a client is ready to process trauma, they let us know, and that's when we do it. Not because someone else thinks they're ready, but when they're ready. The second piece of a trauma-focused therapy principle is that we provide psychoeducation first and throughout treatment. That's the first thing we do, is teach people about their diagnosis. And whether that's trauma-related or not, people have the right to understand what their diagnosis is and what that means and what type of treatment is most effective for that diagnosis. And then throughout treatment, we educate people, because we are building self-sufficiency. We want people to understand what is happening at all times, and specifically the caregivers. We want them to know what we're doing, why we're doing it. And I always tell parents when I meet with them, I want you to ask me questions. Don't feel like, I mean, I think some providers say, well, you know, you're not supposed to ask the doctor the question. You're not supposed to ask the specialist the question. No, they're my client. that's my job, is to answer questions, and they need to keep me on my toes. So you need to come up with questions that I've never heard of, because I want to know what you're thinking and what you need. That's how we build the relationship, and that's how we meet our goals in therapy. So psychoeducation is very important, which is what we're doing right now, just educating people about psychotherapeutic topics. And then number three, empowerment. Like we were just talking about the empowerment principles. Empowerment is about helping people find the power in themselves to heal themselves. But empowerment is also about advocacy. And Tristan and I were just on a call with a client who we are trying to advocate for, because this seems to be an issue within the provider field right now. I don't know if any of you are coming across this, but you make a referral for therapy and the agency brings the child in or the client in and does an intake. And then they tell the client or the caregiver, I'm sorry, but we don't have any therapists to work with that client. That to me is unethical. And it also sets up a major liability for that agency, because once you bring a client in, they are your client, whether you're seeing them or not. You sign that consent to treatment, you're responsible for them. So Tristan and I were just on a call to kind of figure out how we're going to meet the needs of this client that we have right now, but they are so far away, there's some safety concerns. So we're trying to figure out who else can work with this kid. And we're really not having a very good time with the agency that was supposed to pick her up a month ago. But getting back to empowerment, part of our work is to model for that parent how to ask for what you need, how to advocate for your child, how to communicate in a way that people will hear you and want to help you, right? These are all skills that caregivers need, especially when their child has some kind of disability or a mental health problem or behavioral issue. So we are modeling for that parent. And we're also saying to the providers, like, we are sticking up for our clients, because that's our job, is to help our clients get what they need. Because lots of times people who've experienced trauma and people who are living in poverty and people of color don't have power, or they don't think they have any power. In a lot of cases, they don't. And so it's our job, part of our job, to advocate for our clients and be the voice for them and help them to find their own voice. And then finally, in terms of trauma-focused therapy, we use a phase-oriented treatment model, and we're going to go into that in one moment. That's really, it's a cycle of therapy. It's different stages of therapy, but we don't always get to the trauma processing. So the stages of trauma treatment are safety, remembrance and mourning, and reconnection and integration. Once we go through one of these phases, it doesn't mean that it cannot be repeated. The other thing I want to tell you is that sometimes people go from safety, they get into the trauma processing, and then they say, nope, we need to go back to safety again. So we can keep going back through these stages at any time. The other point I want to make, like I was saying earlier, you don't always get to the processing stage. Sometimes people come into therapy and all they want to do is build safety, a sense of safety, and that's okay. So let's go through these stages, and then I want to leave some room for questions, leave some time for questions. So the first stage of trauma treatment is, again, safety. So we're building that therapeutic relationship. We're building that trust. We're providing psychoeducation, as I said earlier, because we know that knowledge is power, and we want to give our clients as much power as we can, which is empowerment principles. We are going to teach them how to increase their ability to help their body calm down, right? And what we're doing is activating something called the parasympathetic nervous system. So we're doing everything we can to give them skills to retrain their brain to find safety in their bodies and in their environments. And so in their environments, it's really difficult, by the way, to do trauma therapy with someone who is not currently in a safe environment. We're pretty limited on what we can do other than to build safety. So does that mean we can't do trauma therapy with someone who is currently in a domestic violence situation? No, we can do therapy. Will we process trauma? No. Will we see them through teletherapy or virtual sessions? No. It's too dangerous, right? Increasing safety in their environment, that includes helping them address substance abuse issues, violence that's happening within the home or within their communities, getting them into a safe place. That's the number one goal in this stage of therapy. We want clients to know that they're in control of their body, and that gives them the courage to go to the next stage of therapy, which is what everyone thinks of when they think about trauma therapy, which is the processing of the trauma, remembrance and mourning. So remember I said to you, if someone brings someone into therapy and the first thing they do is go in, is want to talk about the trauma story, that's a big red flag. So you notice safety in itself, you saw all the elements of safety. That takes a while sometimes to get to that point where people do feel safe. So to just jump right into the remembrance and mourning, again, I just want to emphasize for you, that's not the way it should be done. Once someone is ready to go into their cup, right? Remember this metaphor, go into the cup to address those holes and begin to repair the damage, then we enter this stage of treatment. And what we do is we can't change the past, right? The trauma is an old story. But what we do is we reconstruct and transform that story so that if it was a story of being a victim, we help them transform the story about being a survivor. We work on challenging negative thoughts and belief systems and core negative beliefs. We help them to grieve losses, and we reduce symptoms and work on the memories so that they have hope. This actually, and we do something called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, or EMDR. And this is another thing I can tell you about at some point if people are interested. Just add it to the chat box if you're interested. The processing part of EMDR is usually the shortest period in the EMDR protocol. And some of you might be like, really? That's surprising. But remember, we're building safety. So before we can do any processing, we have to build that sense of safety and connection. And then finally, the third stage of trauma treatment is the reconnection and integration. So we're helping that client to develop skills that may have been lost or they never developed because they were so busy trying to survive their life. We work on forgiveness. We work on confronting and moving through fear, restoring self-esteem, and finding meaning and purpose in the trauma that they've experienced. So you might ask, how do they do that? That's part of the integration, is knowing that this happened to me. It's part of my story, but it's not all that I am. It's not who I am. And that's what recovery from trauma looks like. Is that people come to this place in their life that they can separate from what's happened in the past and live their life and be free of that burden. So that concludes my presentation. I'm wondering if anyone has any questions at this point. I would love to answer. What if the parent is unable or unavailable to participate in the therapy? That is a great question. This is something we grapple with every day. One of the things that we tell people before they even come in to therapy, so we say to them, we tell parents, you are going to be working just as hard, if not harder, than your child. And 99.9% of caregivers that we talk to say, I'm in, because I want to know how to help my kid. Most of the time, it's not an issue because we talk about it before we even set up the intake. We talk about it again at the intake, And then we also have a presentation that we do. We talk about what is therapy. And we talk about it again. It's in all of our literature. They get this message many times that they are going to participate in therapy. And if they can't or they don't want to, then this therapy is probably not going to be the best therapy for them. Because the reason is it's not going to be effective. We know this because we've been doing this for 13 years. We know that we can actually predict at this point when a child is going to be okay based on the first few conversations with the parent, if they are invested and if they want this. And if they are, we know the child's going to be okay. We always tell parents, it's not as important that your child like me, right? It's nice that kids like you. Who doesn't like to be, you know, when you see a child and they say, oh, Miss Diane, it's so nice to see you, right? And then other kids come in and they're like, sup, I don't really want to be here. I tell parents that my job is to help your child attach more securely to you, not to me. My job is not to be friends with your child. My job is to teach them, give them the tools they need, and teach you what you need so that you don't need me anymore. So I always tell parents that I want you to like me. That's more important because you're bringing your child to therapy. And even if the child loves you and the parent doesn't think that the services are important or worthy or, you know, worth their time, then the therapy is not going to be effective because they're not going to bring the child to services anyway. So building that relationship with caregivers is key to making progress with the child. Any other questions? What about the unwilling caregiver? The unwilling caregiver. If someone in this group or anyone else that you know of can teach me how to motivate someone to change their behavior, other than, of course, you know, giving them information and saying, well, if you don't do this, you know, motivational interviewing, I don't know if you've heard of that. That's a type of therapy where you kind of point out the discrepancies. And if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen, right? So we try to do that. But I have not yet learned how to make somebody change their behavior. If they want to do it, they will do it. And if they don't want to do it, then there's nothing that we can do to help. Because I tell parents that we're not magic. Remember the last time we met, we talked about my role as a therapist. Some people think that we are auto mechanics. So they think that you bring your child in and we look them over and we fix the child. You just drop them off at the office and we fix them. But I tell people that I'm not an auto mechanic. I work at AutoZone. AutoZone is where you bring the car in. They give you an assessment. They help you figure out what's wrong with the car, quote unquote. And then they give you tools, literally. They give you the parts to fix the car. And that's what we do as therapists. That's what we're supposed to do as therapists. Is we enable people, we give them the tools so that they can heal themselves. If someone comes into therapy and says, I don't want to do this, I don't want to participate, there's really not much that I can do other than say, well, would you like to, I mean, is there a reason for that? Is there, you know, maybe they've had a bad experience with another therapist. Maybe they feel very vulnerable. Maybe they're afraid. And so it's about building that relationship so that they can feel comfortable and feel safe with us and trust us. Is your therapy always done in person? Another great question. Not always. No, we do offer virtual therapy. It depends on several different things. My staff and I will not do trauma processing through Zoom because I think it's too dangerous and I won't do it. I don't care what anybody says or what, I mean, the research isn't even out on this yet. There are some clinicians that are doing that. I'm not one of them. However, there's lots of other things that we can do through teletherapy, including cognitive behavioral therapy, some play therapy, some DBT, some internal family systems. It just depends on the situation. So for clients who have a substance abuse issue, there are safety concerns, you know, things of that nature, we're not going to do teletherapy. But if it's that they're pretty, you know, their functioning is pretty okay, but they just can't get to the office, they don't have transportation, or they don't want to come to the office twice in a week, as is in the case of our caregivers. We meet with the child once, and then we meet with the child separately. We meet with the child and then we meet with the caregiver separately a second time during the week. And oftentimes parents can't come into the office twice, so that we have a virtual session with them. So we are incorporating virtual therapy, or teletherapy as we call it. However, I want to emphasize, and this is my perspective, but I think my staff share this as well, there's nothing to replace in-person therapy. I don't care how good your Zoom is and your platform, there is nothing to replace it, because the energy that you get and the connection that you share with another person and what you can pick up in body language, et cetera, there's so many problems with teletherapy we don't have time to go into right now. But do you accept managed care Medicaid? Yes, ma'am. We accept all different types of Medicaid. First Choice by Select Health, Absolute Total Care, Molina, Blue Choice Medicaid, and also straight fee-for-service Medicaid. Well, I hope this information has been helpful to you. I hope that you have a better sense of what trauma therapy is and whether, you know, your clients come to Merrimack Valley Trauma Services or go to another therapist, at least hopefully you'll have a better understanding of what the process looks like so that you can appropriately make referrals and advocate for your clients. So I thank you so much for being here. I hope that you can join us next month on March 31st at 12 o'clock. If you have any questions, you have my phone number, you have my email address. I also welcome you to visit our website at mvtraumaservices.com if you'd like to learn more about our programs and services. And also there's a link on the homepage to make referrals. But I thank you so much for being here, and I hope to see you next month.